Very happy that we have from overseas our good friend Martin, who is going to talk on Mozart, early Mozart recordings. I didn't know he had late, well, I guess it means young Mozart. I didn't know where in his discography these fell, but thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Sam. I have two handouts here, and one duplicates what you could see on the screen. So perhaps if the people in the back. Ladies and gentlemen, many works by Mozart belong to the most popular of all recorded music. And it may be safely assumed that during the past 50 years, Mozart has been among the three most frequently recorded composers altogether. The statistics given over a span of a decade in the Schwann catalogues during the 1960s and 1970s indicate such prominent position. If phonograph records have their value as sources for performance practices, which I believe they have, this applies particularly to recordings of works by composers as prominently recorded as Mozart. But when did recorded sound become more than just a random document? As of when did it represent a certain established style? To answer this question, we may have to distinguish between the genres within Mozart's works. When we look at premiere recordings of major compositions by Mozart, we quickly realize that for most of the recordings made before the 1930s, there's no real way to distinguish between stylistically important and unimportant performances due to a lack of alternatives. Generally speaking, most instrumental and orchestral works that we consider major now were left unrecorded during the first 30 or even 40 years of the 20th century. For instance, although his three last symphonies, number 39, 40, and 41, were firstly recorded in 1913 and 1915, respectively. As they were severely cut, those discs hardly represent more than the limitations of the sound carrier imposed on the composition. Furthermore, they were not done by a symphony orchestra proper, but by a pickup group of players. Even the first complete Mozart opera recordings, the famous Glyndebourne sets of 1934 through 1936, which were conducted by Fritz Busch, they were per se not necessarily representative for the Mozart style of their time altogether. Rather, they document one and only one interpretive approach. That this, however, was to become worldwide appreciated is a sign not only of the pure musical quality of these performances, but also of the impact of modern recording and marketing on the appreciation of music. The fact that these discs were for almost 20 years the only recorded and issued performances of the three Da Ponte operas had an enormous influence. I may argue, had Fred Geisberg, the producer of these three truly great opera recordings, produced the Metropolitan Opera performances led by Bruno Walter, we may have experienced a different prevailing Mozart style altogether in the course of the decades following the Glyndebourne recordings. Not all first recordings were as influential as the Glyndebourne sets. Among the lesser known first recordings were several chamber music discs of important works. Among these compositions, like the clarinet quintet and the horn quintet. They were firstly recorded by well-established London musicians, but produced not by a major record company, but by enterprising connoisseurs around the editor of the gramophone magazine, Sir Compton Mackenzie. And this business, named the National Gramophonic Society, enjoyed naturally only limited distribution. However, when somebody as prominent as Arthur Schnabel recorded Mozart concertos, and he did two first concerto recordings, namely the double concerto K365 with his son Ulrich at the second piano, and of the concerto number 21 in C major, K491. Such a recording met quite a different public response. But even so, until well into the 1950s, critics were hardly able to discuss recordings in terms of performance style. Instead, they tended to discuss the composition as such and made occasional remarks on the recording proper, and even less frequently on the performance. The craftsmanship to listen to different recordings and discuss them was simply not easily feasible. But even then, when it could have been done, it was not really an established feature of record criticism. It was the advent of the long-playing record which created, as it were, authors like J.B. Skeen. Before then, it was only the English critic Hermann Klein writing for the Gramophone who had a certain ability to discuss vocal recordings in musical terms. In the case of vocal recordings, the situation in respect to recording was somewhat more complex than in the case of Mozart's instrumental music. In 1925, Klein complained in the Gramophone, quote, "The available collection of Mozart gramophone records can scarcely be termed a truly representative one, so far as the voice is concerned." This statement by Klein is wrong and true at the same time. Yet Klein did not assume, quote, "that the time has come for recording any of Mozart's operas from the first note to the last." Why? The fact that Mozart's operas would not sell as well as Madama Butterfly or Faust did at that time was only an indication, but not a proper reason. Economic failures do not exist on their own. There are aesthetic reasons attached to them. And for Klein, it was that reason that he considered, in line with most other phonograph buyers, the recitativi secchi as arid wastes in musical terms. Mozart's arias had become for Klein, and with him for most people listening to Mozart's music then, a quality of its own beyond their place within a musico-dramatic context. They were merely music and not embedded in an action, but as opposed to the development of a generation beyond Klein, Mozart's recitativo writing had not yet been its own musical qualities, had not yet received its own musical qualities in the appreciation of the listeners. The lack of a repertoire of words and phrases to describe musical performances may seem strange when we consider how many vocal recordings of Mozart arias, in fact, had been made during the acoustic era. There had been produced virtually hundreds of arias recordings from Le Nozze di Figaro, Don Giovanni, and above all, The Magic Flute, since the turn of the century. Some 600 selections altogether, at least. But listeners must have had only little chance to listen to a substantial number of them, partially because discs were very expensive at that time, partially because there was little feasibility to listen to recordings which did not belong to one's own household. Even if this was to a certain extent made up for by local gramophone societies, we must not underestimate the influence of classical radio programs on the oral education of people since the introduction of FM. Nevertheless, many acoustic recordings still survive and are readily available in transfers on CD. So we can listen now to many of them and compare them with each other in a systematic fashion. Due to the sheer number of recordings of basically the same dozen of arias, Mozart recordings from the first 30 years of the 20th century can tell us more about than about individual approaches, but about performing traditions and new conceptions. But these were never ensembles. Although already as early as around 1840, the famous Belgian music historian François-Joseph Fétis, in his Biographie universelle des musiciens, praised the two finales of Le Nozze di Figaro as being more abundant in beauties of the first order than any other lyric production, it was not until more than 100 years later, until the Busch recording, that these microcosms of operatic composition could be appreciated on records. Mozart's vocal recordings from the earlier years don't tell us much about what we nowadays consider equally important within an opera performance. They don't tell us about structural approaches, about the proportioning of an entire act, something which makes the classic 1954 set of the Figaro by Erich Kleiber such a recorded treasure. nothing about temporal proportions from one to another aria. Usually, the vocal recordings of the acoustic era have been appreciated and described from the viewpoint of the personality of the singer in question. But there is more to learn from them. They even can help us in establishing an historically authentic Mozart style, perhaps. My presentation will focus on these aspects with the help of historic sound documents. When we listen to and analyze recordings, both historical and modern, we gain, first of all, insight into performance practices vanished and not recorded elsewhere. I would like to discuss with you one little example as a case study. My example is De Vieni alla Finestra, the canzonetta sung by Don Giovanni in the second act. To choose such a simple song might need some explanation. There are no particular difficulties to tackle by the singer, no coloratura passages, no demanding melodic line, and no uncomfortable tessitura. Everything is brief and straight to the point. Yet it is this simplicity which makes this piece particularly fitting as the medium for the display of performing style. No technical difficulties to overcome could hinder the intentions of the singer to come to the surface. Everything here is style and nothing else. Another reason is that this canzonetta, also known as Serenade or Ständchen, has been a particular favorite of the early Mozart discs. Between 1898 and 1925, there had been more than 80 acoustic recordings of it. It is one of the favorites of the acoustic recording era. Being too short to fill the whole side of a 12-inch disc, the format of the sound carrier influenced the appreciation of it in a variety of different ways. Some recordings were issued on 7-inch discs only, but three artists provided a bonus. Antonio Scotti added Quando Baccio from Verdi's Falstaff, Emilio de Gorgorza gave the serenade from Berlioz's Faust, and Maurice Renault repeated the last verse in Italian after singing the main canzonetta in his vernacular French. When we look back at the careers of the singers who recorded Mozart in general and the canzonetta in particular, we observe that most of them were not just Mozart singers, but equally or even more famed for their Verdi and Wagner singing. I cannot discuss this observation within my presentation, but it is certainly worthwhile to look into this phenomenon at another time. What actually does happen in this little piece? Don Giovanni stands in front of the window of Donna Elvira's chambermaid, a mandolin in his hands, and sings a stylized canzonetta. During the 18th century, the canzonetta was a brief solo song with a simple accompaniment that can be played on a keyboard or, as in the case of Mozart's opera, on a mandolin. Typical for this canzonetta, as a popular form of poetry, is the use of the verse of the endecasillabo, which means that there are 11 syllables within a verse. Konrad Küster, the German musicologist, has shown that Mozart cunningly demonstrates in this canzonetta how Don Giovanni, as a member of aristocracy, tries to perform a typical song as sung among the lower classes, but fails because of wrong stress values. The canzonetta, therefore, is a piece of music about music and society. It is a piece of musical humor. In modern performances, this canzonetta is always sung very much the way Samuel Ramey has rendered it in his 1985 recording conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Regarding the tempo structure, there has never been a different approach, neither on stage nor on record, for the past 50 years that I'm aware of. There is a certain plebeian coarseness in Ramey's style, which quite fits as Don Giovanni has dressed up himself as a member of the lower class. What is the main musical line here in this very performance? The runs and broken chords of the mandolin in virtually every bar, or is it the vocal line? Track 6, please.
De vieni alla finestra, o mio
There's certainly a perfect blending of this sung stanza with the accompaniment in this recording. But is this really what it should be? To discuss this, I will refer to historic recordings. Among the many shellac discs of the canzonetta is one of 1904 with the famous baritone Victor Morel recording it for Phonotypia at the age of 56. A celebrated Verdi singer, Morel ended his career on stage in that very year, 1904. Before I play this controversial recording to you, let me point out the important feature of it so that you know right from the start what to pay particularly attention to. It is the tempo, or better, the meter, as there's a constant change of meter. And incidentally, observe the wrong note in the second stanza and the resulting being not together of singer and pianist. In bar 26, Morel shortens the bar by singing a quaver note instead of a crotchet. This defect accounts for a slight rhythmic confusion on behalf of the pianist, who quickly returns to the meter. Compare the two performances by Remy and Morel in terms of meter, I have prepared a chart for you. So on the left, you have the metronomic markings, and here are, on the right, are the bars. And if you look at your handout, it's I've only used the second part. And always semi-bars. The most obvious and stunning difference concerns the flexibility of tempo. Without going into the tricky business of defining the term tempo, I present you with this graph giving the tempos of both Rameh's and Morel's performances. This and the graph that follows present the tempo for each semi-bar of this second stanza only. Although the graph doesn't give information beyond what already can be heard, its visual transformation usefully summarizes the sound in motion. Rameh's tempo fluctuations are negligible. they are between 39 and 52. One can safely speak of an average tempo of 47. In Morel's performance, on the other hand, it wouldn't make sense to determine something like an average tempo, as the fluctuations reach from 19 to 72, taking into account also the fermatas, which arguably should be separated in any statistical interpretation. Anyway, two big fluctuations occur in conjunction with the instrumental interlude and the instrumental postlude. So it's not just a matter of the tempo of the singer, but also the tempo or the meter of the accompanist. For the effect of a fermata, Morel slows down in the respective last bar before both the interlude and the postlude. Yet the pianist doesn't catch up to the general tempo. Instead, he accelerates to a tempo of 64 and 72, respectively.
Here you have these accelerations.
Morel sings the canzonetta like an improvised song, not like a carefully studied aria. The structure is simple, as is the accompaniment on the mandolin. Everything beyond is a matter of the situation. The canzonetta develops out of the acting and singing. The stanzas are structured by the interludes, and the standardized runs and chords of the interludes are played quicker than the text is sung, as if the singer accompanies himself on the instrument and hastens to continue singing. Here, where the sung word develops out of the mood of the situation, the instrumental accompaniment has to subordinate. After all, Don Giovanni sings this song in order to seduce the chambermaid and not to follow the quaver strumming. Therefore, certain vowels in the words like bell'amore get a rubato in order to stress their importance. Is Morel's recording a bizarre exception for Mozart singing? Not at all. It is in line with one branch of the performance practice at the turn of our century, of the last century. There are other historical recordings of the canzonetta that display the same tendency.
Have a look at this chart.
Here are six performances compared. And this graph incorporating some of those recordings from the same period show the same general speeding up for the interlude and postlude. Many, I dare say most Mozart recordings before the mid-1920s are distinguished by similar parameters of musical style. They are documents of a lost kind of organic music making. Nowadays, hardly a singer would dare singing with similar fluctuations. Hardly a conductor dare spend speeding up the interludes to similar effect. Instead of dismissing these performances as unstylish, as a modern critic and a modern listener would do, I argue historically and would rather ask why later performances have become so different. One of the first European singers doing a modern interpretation was Ezio Pinza, as can be heard in his individual 1930 recording of the piece, as well as in his broadcasts of the 1937 Salzburg Festival performance of the whole opera conducted by Bruno Walter, and of the 1942 Met performance again with Walter as conductor. Pinza, by the way, also does not sing an appoggiatura on Finestra. Here is his 1930 studio recording of the piece.
Vieni alla finestra, oh mio tesoro, de vieni a consolar il pianto mio. Se neghi a me di dar qualche ristoro, davanti agli occhi tuoi morir voglio.
Our view of performing Mozart has been influenced by the aesthetic upheaval of the 1920s, emphasizing a modern performance practice oriented towards the beat of an imaginary metronome. No other than von Karajan had been instrumental in advocating such approach. He always stressed the importance of rhythmical precision, which he understood as keeping the beat, which is, historically speaking, a rather doubtful musical category. Mozart himself spoke of Clementi as a mere mechanic with no penny of feeling or taste. Here it is rather unimportant if Mozart had pleaded for Morel's or Rameh's approach. What is important is the fact that through sound recordings we can witness the loss of a certain tradition of performance practice, which has been superseded by the doubtful gain in equality. During the first quarter of the last century, recorded music was considered mechanical music, even such a live recording as Morel's. A century after Morel's document of mechanical music, the by far highest percentage of music listened to is mechanically produced music. Therefore, we don't speak of mechanical music anymore. Instead, we speak of live music or live performances as the exception from the rule. Yet in the course of the decades, live music has become mechanical, and music once considered mechanical is for us now the ultimate in spontaneous music making. There is even more to it. The ideal of mechanization has become the aesthetic ideal of music criticism. Performances are more and more judged by the technical standard of music making. From this viewpoint, Morel's performance is full of faults. Regarding tempo, there are admittedly also some interpretations of the canzonetta that display a different approach altogether. Morel's recording represents, as it were, a French tradition, which we can also hear from Jean-François Delmas.
L'excellente aventure, dit à la camériste une chanson d'amour.
This was Jean-François Delmas. To end my presentation, I would like to give you two further musical examples showing a different style. Quite different from this French style was Tita Ruffo, who seems to represent an Italian tradition. His two recordings of 1907 and 1912, respectively, have certain similarities, different as they are. This difference between these two renderings, which are just 5 years apart, lies in the tempo. Ruffo sings in both recordings rather strict in meter for most of the measures, save for the final phrases of each stanza. In both versions, he, as an Italian, observes the melodic flow by singing the appoggiatura on finestra, and he also lets his voice go up a third above the octave, higher than the notated D1 in the final phrase, and holds this top note as a long cadenza-like ornament.
Tutte hai la bocca dolce,
it's now the second stanza.
Del miele, tutte il zucchero porti in mezzo al cuore. Tutte
The 1912 Titarufo performance. With John Brownlee's interpretation within the Glyndebourne set of 1936, we have the modern approach of new objectivity in Mozart. But we learn at the same time that performing styles cannot in every aspect be labeled, as Brownlee does sing the appoggiatura on Finestra, although Busch, his conductor, despised appoggiaturas. When we listen to other early recordings of the canzonetta, particularly one seems to stand out for its modern approach. It is the one by Emilio de Gogorza of 1913. Gogorza's interpretation is as modern as Ezio Pinza's and John Brownlee's, yet almost 20 years earlier than Brownlee. No wonder, as he was the teacher of Brownlee at one time. Gogorza sings the appoggiatura, but the tempo is as strict as you can think it could be in those days, and there are only very few deviations from the written notes. Somehow the American baritone with Spanish ancestors does not fit into the framework of national European schools of Mozart singing. Let's listen to the Gogorza recording.
Vieni alla finestra, oh mio tesoro, vieni a consolar il pianto mio. Se ne chiame di dar qualche davanti agli occhi tuoi morir voglio.
When Michael Scott writes, Gogorza sings this serenade, I quote, without exaggerating particular words at the expense of the vocal line, this is true, but the singer and his critic fail to place the serenade within its dramatic context. It may be true, quote, Don Giovanni could hardly have achieved all those conquests without having had first and foremost an ingratiating manner, as Scott puts it. But here in this serenade, the Don disguises as someone else of the lower class. I am, however, puzzled by what Hermann Klein wrote in 1925 about Emilio de Gogorza's recording of the canzonetta. Quote, of these recordings by several eminent baritones, I like best the Gogorza, not only for its vocal qualities, but because the tempo and general interpretation are in accord with tradition. This is indeed a surprising statement, which needs to be interpreted, not by me now, but perhaps by the distinguished audience. Thank you for your attention.
I kept waiting for that mandolin go da 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 dum bum, but anyway, would have fit in that piece. I'm so glad that Gary is following you, because I think this will be sort of a provocative pairing. Gary Gallo is the audio engineer.
Gallo.
We've been calling you Gary Gallo for years.